This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, Managing Editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We have a very interesting program today. Elections in Turkey dealt a real blow to the credibility and perhaps even the power of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. This man has been moving the country toward Islamism for some years and away from democracy. But here the people of Turkey gave a pretty strong rebuke to the direction he's been taking the country. This is a story with very interesting prophetic implications. We're going to have a conversation with Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about those elections. And next we'll have a conversation with the Trumpet.com's managing editor Brad McDonald about some fascinating history that is prophecy. Our editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has been talking for the last couple of years about how U.S. President Donald Trump is a modern-day type of the ancient King Jeroboam II of Israel. And he's presiding over a resurgence in America, very much like the one that Jeroboam oversaw anciently just before Israel's collapse. Mr. McDonald has been studying the history of the Assyrian Empire, which ended up conquering Israel. And there are some amazing parallels with what is happening in Germany and America today. After that, we'll talk about an anniversary. This Friday, it marks the 50-year anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. This is an event in New York that a lot of people consider the start of the modern LGBT movement. This month is considered LGBT Pride Month, so we'll hear a report from the newest addition to the Trumpet writing staff, Rufaro Manyepa. He's going to give us an overview of the history of this movement and how it has managed to reshape society so quickly. At the end of the program, we'll answer a very important question that a lot of people are confused about. What is sin? We'll begin, though, by talking about these elections in Turkey. To talk about this, we have via Skype from Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hi.
So why did these elections take place, first of all?
So Istanbul was back at the ballot box because in March, the victory that Ekrem İmamoğlu had was deemed too close to call. It's about 15,000 votes. Here you've got a city of about 15 million people, one of the largest cities in the world, and it was just too close to call. And it wasn't, the winner of it wasn't the preferred candidate of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And so he determined that it was best, because of so-called irregularities in the voting process, to go away, annul that vote, and to come back on June 23rd and have another vote for the mayor of Istanbul.
And so this time the result was even more in favor of this candidate that Erdogan is not interested in having in power.
Right. So ever since that March 25 vote, every single opinion poll that's come out, it seemed that Erdogan's candidate of the Justice and Development Party, the AKP, kept on losing ground, and that was confirmed with the election. There was, I believe, 85% of Istanbul came out to vote, so huge turnout for this. In fact, there was a lot of different normal tourist attractions on the coast that basically shuttered their doors to send everyone back to Istanbul to vote. And so a huge outpouring of voting, and he ended up winning this time by a lead of about 800,000 votes. So I think Erdogan's candidate got 44%, and İmamoğlu ended up getting about 54%. So about 10% difference.
And there were, obviously, you kind of alluded to the fact that there were people who felt like the first election really should have stood, that they were raised their eyebrows at the fact that Erdogan nullified that result. And I think there would also be people who would say that he did everything that he could to try to stack this revote in his favor. Maybe you could just talk about that a little bit, like how and fair was this election to begin with?
Right. Well, nothing's free and fair in Turkey right now, just because going back to the massive purge that took place in 2016 after the attempted coup, we had all of the media outlets, independent media outlets inside Turkey get shut down. And unless you were pro-Erdogan, you weren't going to have a voice. And so even the election coverage of the days following the election, like yesterday, all of the papers were, you know, Istanbul had its election, and just generic terms about the election. No one was, you know, trumpeting the end of Erdogan or the end of AKP or anti-Erdogan party, you know, takes Istanbul. That wasn't it. And so he controls the media. He also ensures that he went out to actually try and get the Kurdish vote. The Kurds back in May they make up for about 2 to 3 million people inside Istanbul. They're a minority in Turkey, but a huge minority. They didn't come out and vote for İmamoğlu back then. They mainly voted for the AKP and other parties. And so Erdogan came out. He even allowed one of the leaders from prison that's currently incarcerated to send a note out to his followers to try and, as he saw it, to try and support Erdogan's party. But they decided not to. The Kurds actually voted against Erdogan's party in this case. And so you ended up having this landslide. And Erdogan, of course, has said, as the mayor of Istanbul before, back in 1994 to 1998, that's where he started off his political career before he went to prison for a while. He actually said that if you lose Istanbul, you lose Turkey. So he was doing all he could to help his preferred candidate. But it just seemed that the more he helped, the worse off his candidate became.
So you would say it's probably fair to say that 800,000 votes in the favor of this opposition candidate probably reflect an even greater public support, or maybe we could say it, look at it as an anti-Erdogan vote in a lot of ways.
Exactly. I think that's what most people were looking at this. I mean, this is a huge percent. It's 20% of Turkey's population. And so it is kind of a referendum on him. He is seen as, well, he rules by fiat basically now. Back in 2018, sorry, he was elected as the president. That's following the 2017 referendum that changed the election system or the governance system inside Turkey, which granted the president supreme powers or much more powers like into a dictator. And so while you did have 52% and 54% in 2017 and 18 come and basically say to Erdogan, okay, we will let you have these powers. Something has obviously changed in, let's say, the last 6 to 12 months that has probably 6 months that has led the public away from the direction of Erdogan's rule.
Okay, we definitely need to talk about that more and what this means for his future. Just to button this up, you said Erdogan says whoever wins Istanbul rules Turkey. Help us to understand why the mayoral election in this city has such importance.
Well, Istanbul is seen as largely a reflection on how the country would vote itself, just because it has a broad set cross-section of different types of people. And so, although the parliamentary elections that would unseat Erdogan, or the presidential elections that would unseat him, aren't till 2023, you get insight into how the country would go based on Istanbul. And also the fact that Istanbul controls a lot of the income, the economy for the nation as well. So there's a lot of money bound up in ruling Istanbul.
So you mentioned the presidential elections before and the referendum where Erdogan basically took considerably more power to himself. There were a lot of people saying this was the death of democracy in Turkey. This seems to be kind of the resurgence of this democratic impulse within the Turkish people. What does this election mean for Erdogan going forward? And obviously, those powers that he took to himself, this didn't nullify any of that. So he's still a very, very powerful figure.
Right. We can't overplay what this actually means. Erdogan still has those powers. He's still ruling for another 4 years before his rule technically would be threatened unless there's some type of mass protest. But he's not going to go quietly into the night. He's been the dominant figure in Turkish politics for 25 years. So he'll be around. He's got a couple of choices. If this does spark a mass protest movement against him, democracy does look like it is alive and well inside Turkey. So that might happen. Then we might see him either decide to forcefully put down such protests because he'll have the power to do that as he's done before. Or we might see Erdogan try and recalibrate his position as well. I mean, he has 4 years to try and change tact a little bit, to answer to the people, to still maintain the power that he has, but to show that he can listen to the population. I mean, at the end of the day, he cares most about retaining power rather than, you know, the huge, I would say, I don't think the Turkish policy... I mean, he is an Islamist ruler, but I don't think he's going to take Turkey down that path unless he has some type of popular support behind him. And so he could also just decide to cut off the funding because the federal government, it allows the municipalities to have their funding to go about their different programs that they want. And so he could decide to limit the funding that this man has and see him suffer for 4 years. Say you had your chance at democracy, look how it treated you. So there's a couple of ways that he could go. Now, what it does seem is that I would say, if we're going to look at this in biblical prophecy, we see a number of Erdogan's positions right now that don't fall in line with biblical prophecy. And so it might seem that he would either be replaced eventually or that he might moderate his position somewhat to move the nation back towards the West, away from the Islamist leanings that it looked like it was going on.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. And that is an interesting way of viewing this. First of all, everything that you said about what he might do going forward, I just think we cannot underestimate just how brutal this man can be. I mean, in terms of silencing opposition, as much as he would love to enjoy the kind of popular support from his people that you're talking about, that doesn't seem to be his primary motivator. And yet this is a powerful message coming from the Turkish people that you could see him trying to respond to in some way or other. So let's just talk about the prophecies, what we expect to see in Turkey, and how, if he were to moderate or maybe back away from some of the more extreme Islamist type positions, it would actually fall in line with what we would expect.
Right. So I'll just talk about a couple of his positions right now and then show how they don't fall in line with Bible prophecy. One of those is his realignment towards Russia. Right now, he is in this big firestorm with the Trump administration and Erdogan right now, because Turkey has decided that they're going to accept the S-400, which is the Russian anti-aircraft and anti-missile shield. And basically, if you do that, this is a NATO country, remember, then that system can learn the abilities of the F-35 and other fighter jets that are pro-NATO. And so the US has decided, hey, you're not going to get any of our F-35 fighter jets if you accept this Russian defense system. And so Turkey's tried to play the middle game. And so what we generally see in Bible prophecy, though, is that Turkey is going to move to side with Europe and the other NATO nations there as opposed to Russia. So they might come back from that edge. We also know that Erdogan and Turkey right now is a firm supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And eventually, Bible prophecy, based on other prophecies in Daniel chapter 11 and Psalm 83 as well, we know that they aren't going to be the foremost sponsor of Islamism in terms of political Islam as they are right now. Iran is going to hold the mantle of that. And so you could see him leaning back away from his Islamist tendencies there. You could also see that his relationship with Europe must improve. This Psalm 83 alliance has a lot of Middle Eastern nations such as Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, and Turkey being one of them, that are going to be allied with Europe. And right now, Turkey's relationship with Europe is not good whatsoever. He's constantly threatening the European nations that he's going to flood them with refugees if they don't submit to him and do what he wants. And so we're going to see that's going to change as well, that relationship. So we know that there is going to be a shift back towards the West. But when I say West, I don't mean the United States. Turkey, the Bible prophecy, there was one book of the Bible, the book of Obadiah, that basically outlays the prophecy for Turkey. And it is chilling, the message of Obadiah, because it talks about how Edom and also Taman, it calls them, or Otaman, which the Ottoman Empire ruled from, was based in Turkey and ruled over the Middle East for 400 years. So when it's talking about the nations inside that book of Obadiah, it's talking about the Turks, and it talks about how they don't have a good relationship with Israel, biblical Israel, which the United States, Britain, and even the Jews in the Middle East make up. And so that book talks about them turning on and actually stabbing in the back the Jewish state and the United States. And so while the Bible says they're going to look westward, that is towards Europe to ally with, not towards the United States.
Erdogan has really, Turkey and Europe have had a fraught relationship for a long time, but it definitely seems that Erdogan has moved away from Europe ideologically and politically in a lot of ways. We've seen this relationship between the two of them hang together just because of mutual shared interests and the way that Europe is having to rely on Turkey as somewhat of a gatekeeper from refugees coming in from the Middle East into Europe. And Turkey has its own reasons for maintaining this relationship with Europe, despite having more of an Islamist type of political bent. So even under Erdogan, you've seen that relationship preserved, even though it is tenuous and tense. It's still solid. So it will be interesting to see how this blow against Erdogan's standing politically would affect that relationship. Do you have any final thoughts about what we might expect just in the near term?
I think in the near term, Erdogan does try to work with this man, doesn't want to create a fight internally. He doesn't need to. Again, he rules for another 4 years without a problem. If democracy is going to play its course, this is what will happen. And so he doesn't need to make any type of quick decisions here. But possibly we can see him decide to change tact again, away from Russia, take the benefits of the United States for the time being, and back towards Europe. That's clearly what Bible prophecy does say will happen. So whether he leads or whether somebody else will, that's the forecast that we know is going to take place.
Well, thank you for that, Brent. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about elections in Turkey this past Sunday that hurt President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. We'll have an article on this subject going up on thetrumpet.com very soon. In the meantime, we'll put a link in the show notes to an article that we have on the website called Why Turkey Matters. You can read that at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for your time, Brent.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The August edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet is going up online today, and it has a blockbuster cover story by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury. Can Donald Trump get control of his divided government? This is the latest in a series of articles he's written over the past 2 years, talking about America's president being a modern-day Jeroboam. That's pointing to an end-time prophecy in Amos 7 about America that refers to the national leader as Jeroboam. The ancient forerunner was Jeroboam II, and there are a lot of interesting aspects of that ancient history that can help us understand what is happening in America today. To talk about this, we have via Skype from England, thetrumpet.com's managing editor, Brad McDonald. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
Terrific. It's great to have you on here. It's been a while, but we're very happy to have you. So if you could start by just give an overview of what Mr. Fleury has talked about with this history and why it's relevant to us today.
Sure. Well, as you said, Mr. Fleury has identified Donald Trump as the modern-day type of Jeroboam II. Who is Jeroboam II? Jeroboam II was a king in Israel in the 8th century. So his reign lasted 41 years in the early 8th century, so from about 797 BC to 753 BC. Under Jeroboam, the kingdom of Israel anciently experienced a pretty phenomenal resurgence. It expanded its territory. The kingdom became incredibly affluent. Its economy began to thrive. So it was the greatest resurgence that Israel had had since the time of King Solomon. And as Mr. Fleury's pointed out, and as the Trumpet has reported on the past couple of years, we've seen Donald Trump have the same kind of effect on Israel or America today. Now, the Bible makes it clear that God is the one that sanctions this resurgence.
Right.
God is supporting Donald Trump. It doesn't all get back to Donald Trump's genius, but God has allowed America and ancient Israel under these Jeroboams to experience a pretty phenomenal renaissance.
This really is fascinating history, and we have in the in this coming Trumpet edition, as a sidebar to that article by Gerald Fleury, we actually have an article by Brent Noctegal called "The King Who Saved Israel Temporarily" that discusses Jeroboam II, and he specifically goes into the history of that resurgence anciently. What's so interesting about this is it was right toward the end of the kingdom of Israel's existence, really, because at the time that they were having this resurgence and they expanded their borders, and there's a certain amount of that same type of resurgence that you see happening in America today, they were under threat from the Assyrian kingdom. And that's actually a major aspect of this history that has strong parallels with what we see today.
That's right. So ancient Israel was really thriving in the from about 800 to 750 BC. It's interesting because at the same time, ancient Assyria had actually gone into a little bit of, let's say, political malaise. There was a lot of division internally within the kingdom of Assyria. Between about 911 BC and 800, the Assyrian people and the Assyrian kingdom had been rising, conquering more and more territory. I think it was 797 BC, the king of Assyria conquered Damascus and subjugated the Syrian people, and he was just about to use that as a springboard into the Levant. But he experienced some civil unrest at home, some domestic troubles back in Nineveh. So the Assyrian king had to leave Damascus and go back to Assyria. And for the next 30 or 40 years, the Assyrians were focusing on these internal conflicts. When the Assyrian king left Damascus, Jeroboam II was actually able to step into the vacuum and take that territory. So the Assyrian king kind of paved the way for Jeroboam II's territorial expansion. And it's just very interesting to think about the parallels with today. We have the United States of America obviously experiencing this resurgence economically, strategically, and at the same time we have Assyria, who we've explained pretty comprehensively is modern day Germany. We've had Assyria really experience a lot of political trouble, a lot of conflict, a lot of instability and uncertainty. Like Assyria anciently, Germany today is a power. It's a massive power. It rules Europe. It was the same anciently. Mm-hmm. Assyria was powerful militarily. It was powerful. It still controlled a lot of territory. But because it had this crisis of leadership during the reign of Jeroboam II, it couldn't really act on that power. It couldn't deploy that power to subjugate or grow its empire. So it was just kind of paralyzed for a few decades. Mm-hmm. Which just happened to be the time of Jeroboam II, much like Germany today.
Yeah. Well, you know, looking at that history, Gerald Fleury brings this out beautifully in those articles that he's written about this, that Israel's rise, as you said, it wasn't because of the genius of Jeroboam II. It was that God decided he wasn't quite ready for Israel to go down. And they were right on the threshold of being destroyed as an empire, and God basically gave them this reprieve. And it's interesting when you look at any of these types of events historically that you recognize God can use a lot of different tools in order to accomplish a particular purpose. Putting a king in power, say there may have been qualities that Jeroboam had that God was able to use in order to provide that resurgence within Israel. But you also see him working on the other side of the ledger, and those enemies of Israel orchestrating events that cause them to have to back down. Like you said here, the king of Assyria is on the march, and then he's pulled back because of distractions happening domestically. It's a view of world events. It's a view of history that, unless you're really studying the Bible and you can recognize just how many levers God may be pulling in order to affect a certain outcome, you're not necessarily going to pay much attention to those things. But when you see what God is accomplishing, you can see there's actually God is actually very, very involved in these types of events.
That's right. And there's a number of passages in the Bible that talk about that. I think it's he mentions that in Isaiah 47. In Isaiah 10, verse 5, he says very explicitly, "O Assyria, the staff in my hand," I think is the way he puts it. So the Bible identifies Assyria specifically as an instrument God has used to punish Israel. Just a couple of quotes here just to back up what I'm saying. I think these are really fascinating quotes. This first one comes from a history book, These Were God's People. It just says, "These two problems had occupied Syria for the whole first half of the 8th century, which is when Jeroboam was on the throne, allowing Israel to regain her political and economic footing. In fact, at the time of Jeroboam the Second's death in 748, Assyria had lost her northern provinces and was in the throes of a serious civil war." Mm. And then this same historian makes the point that that Israel became very complacent. They didn't pay any attention to Assyria as a threat, even though it was still, you know, a serious power. They paid no attention to it. But then Jeroboam II died, and within just a handful of years, Tiglath-Pileser came along. He destroyed the Assyrian king. He established control of Assyria, and within a year or two, by 745 BC, Tiglath-Pileser was on the warpath, storming across the region, and he even went and invaded Israel. So it changed just like that. This one strong man came in, and Israel, after Jeroboam's death, was just shocked out of its complacency.
Now, listening to everything that you're saying here, anyone who's been listening to the Trumpet Radio or reading the Trumpet for any length of time will immediately pick up on why these details are telling. But if you could just make it explicit why the prophecies of the Bible show that these are very relevant to what is going to happen today.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, there are a number of prophecies in Isaiah 10, verse 5, for example. God says that he will use Assyria, which is modern-day Germany, to punish Israel. That's America and Britain. There are prophecies in Habakkuk that talk about that. There are prophecies in Daniel that talk about the Holy Roman Empire, and specifically a German strongman, a Tiglath-Pileser in the 21st century, being used by God to punish Israel. Hosea, Amos, and Jonah were all contemporaries, and they all preached at the time of Jeroboam II, and they all delivered a warning to Israel during the time of Jeroboam II. And it's just amazing, you know, these prophets went up there to Israel, and they warned, "The Assyrians are rising, the Assyrians are coming." And it fell on deaf ears because Jeroboam II was enjoying this resurgence. Everyone was rich and wealthy, and they were doing whatever their hearts desired. But these three faithful prophets just continued this warning: Assyria is coming, Assyria is coming. They were fobbed off. But then Jeroboam II died, and within just a few years, the German strongman was on the scene. So it just reminded me of even of Mr. Flurry and our work. And, you know, going back to Mr. Armstrong, for decades, we've talked about the Assyrians are coming. Germany is being resurrected. And, you know, there have been times where it hasn't looked like that, or people have looked at Assyria or Germany and they thought, well, Angela Merkel is impotent. The Germans aren't doing anything. But you look at this history, and for those of us that believe this prophecy, you know, we can just have a lot of confidence and just follow the example of Hosea, Amos, Jonah, and we can know that, that these prophecies will be fulfilled.
Well, we sure appreciate that. We've been talking with thetrumpet.com's managing editor, Brad McDonald, about lessons from ancient Israel during the time of King Jeroboam II that apply today, and specifically the state of the Assyrian Empire at that time. A lot of parallels with what's happening in modern-day Germany. Mr. McDonald is working on an article about this. He's going to be talking about it in his Trumpet Brief later on, or I guess tomorrow. The Trumpet Brief is, of course, our email service that you can get for free. If you go onto the front page of thetrumpet.com and sign up, you'll get this brief every day that will keep you informed as to the latest news happening in the world and our insights about it based on the prophecies of the Bible. Thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
June is LGBT Pride Month, and this year marks a particularly big anniversary for this movement that has reshaped society in America and increasingly throughout the world. This change has been aggressive and swift, as we will now hear in this report from our newest addition to the trumpet writing staff, Rufaro Manyepa.
Friday marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. Every June, Gay Pride Month engulfs America and the world in rainbow flags as homosexuals commemorate the revolution that began in Stonewall Inn. These riots saw a police raid on a mafia-run gay bar in Greenwich Village, New York, turned on its head as the homosexuals began attacking the police. The violent protests that followed have been commemorated annually ever since. The LGBT movement found its feet because of those riots, and it has been moving forward ever since. In 1987, authors Marshall Kirk and Erastes Pill wrote an article titled "The Overhauling of Straight America," which outlined the strategy the LGBT movement was going to use to maintain this forward momentum. They wrote that a large-scale media campaign will be required in order to change the image of gays in America. According to marketing expert Paul Rondeau, this strategy had three main phases. First, to force acceptance of homosexual culture into the mainstream. Second, to silence opposition. And third, to ultimately convert American society. This article, which later became a book, outlined the meticulous and concerted effort undertaken by homosexuals to change American society, to remove the taboo from the LGBT movement. Activists first sought to desensitize America to the idea of homosexuality. They undertook a multifaceted campaign aimed at bringing homosexual behavior into public conversation and removing the stigma around it. Next, according to Kirk and Pill, would be casting the gays as victims in need of protection. This would make it possible to take the battle to the courts, where legislation would be used to force acceptance. Over the years that followed came legal victory after legal victory, and they have been gaining speed in more recent years. Lawrence v. Texas decriminalized sodomy. The Defense of Marriage Act, defining marriage as a heterosexual union, was struck down. Anti-discrimination laws are increasingly making anything considered an anti-LGBT a punishable offense. More and more schools are implementing LGBT elements into their curricula and punishing teachers who are unwilling to comply. increasingly, being opposed to the LGBT agenda is not only socially unacceptable, it is illegal. The strategy of forcing acceptance moved homosexuality from being illegal to being considered moral. To enact the second phase, silencing opposition, the idea was to fill mass media with as much pro-LGBT material as possible. This would make those of contrary view feel like they are outnumbered and thus be intimidated away from voicing their views and beliefs about traditional marriage. Beyond that, any who were brave enough to speak up would swiftly be the subject of vitriol and disdain, forced into silence. According to Kirk and Pill, quote, "It will be time to get tough with remaining opponents. To be blunt, they must be vilified. Our goal here is twofold. First, we seek to replace the mainstream self-righteous pride about its homophobia with shame and guilt. Second, we intend to make the anti-gays look so nasty that average Americans will want to disassociate themselves from such types. The public should be shown images of ranting homophobes whose secondary traits and beliefs disgust middle America. These images might include the Ku Klux Klan demanding that gays be burned alive or castrated, bigoted Southern ministers drooling with hysterical hatred to a degree that looks both comical and deranged, menacing punks, thugs, and convicts speaking coolly about the fags they have killed or would like to kill, a tour of Nazi concentration camps where homosexuals were tortured and gassed." End quote. After the murder of Matthew Shepard, a homosexual at the University of Wyoming in 1998, this strategy was shown in full force. Even though his sexual orientation was determined not to be a factor in the crime, all those who opposed homosexuality were lumped in together with his murderers. The same is true today. Anyone who is against homosexuality is portrayed as a white supremacist, hate-filled, even murderous homophobe. Thus, this vocal minority of 4.7% of America's population has been able to effectively silence the overwhelming majority. To ensure effectiveness of the strategy, celebrities are pivotal to the movement. Just last week, pop artist Taylor Swift began using her influence for the cause. She says she is now making music with political undertones, which is clear by the lyrics to her latest song in which she criticizes those who protest gay pride parades, saying they are in the dark ages. Indeed, Kirk and Pill did say the goal was to portray anti-homosexual groups as, quote, "antiquated backwaters, badly out of step with the times and with the latest findings of psychology," end quote. With 118 million followers on Instagram and 83 million followers on Twitter, Taylor Swift has an immense audience. The music video to her pro-LGBT song had 40 million views in just the first 3 days. The video ends with a call to action to sign a petition for the Senate to support the Equality Act, a bill that would expand anti-discrimination laws to include gender identity and thus give preferential treatment to transsexuals. Swift is just one example of how many celebrities today are activists for the LGBT movement, using their platforms for the cause. The mass campaign to convert society culminated in a campaign to create an America that grows up pro-LGBT. Today, many popular animated children's television programs such as My Little Pony, Arthur, Adventure Time, Clarence, and Steven Universe have LGBT characters. All these efforts, from television programming to celebrity activism, have yielded results. With respected and influential public figures adored by millions of fans working with television shows watched by millions worldwide, the effect is evident. 8.4% of millennials are LGBT. In the last 23 years, opposition to same-sex marriage has dropped by 37% and support for it has increased by 36%. The campaign is working. From those roots in 1969, this movement has rapidly extended its branches to grow into a global phenomenon. Gay pride parades are held around the world, from Israel, Zurich, and Greece, to Taipei, Sao Paulo, and Bogota. Until recently, however, though most of the world has converted, Asia, the Middle East, and Africa had remained unyielding. However, in the last few weeks, Botswana, Taiwan, and Ibaraki, a Japanese district, have all taken significant steps to truly globalize the LGBT movement. These breakthroughs show just how far the movement has come. Today, Pride March has returned to the streets of Washington, D.C. for the first time in over a decade. Animated children's programs now have LGBT characters. Pro-transsexual legislation is being passed for schools, and Asian and African nations are beginning to soften towards homosexuality. The ascent of the LGBT movement from illegal to indispensable brings up the question, how long until other illegal ideas such as pedophilia are also legalized, protected, and even encouraged, and at what cost to society?
Thank you very much for that, Rufaro. I think, I wrote the booklet Redefining Family 6 years ago. It was the summer of 2013. And at that time, that was when there was a lot of discussion about legalizing same-sex marriage. That booklet goes into, you reminded me of the strategy that those men employed, and they spelled it out in that material that they put together in the early 80s. The booklet goes through that. It goes through just how they were able to reshape public views on homosexuality when the AIDS epidemic emerged, and there was a real concern that this was actually going to stigmatize homosexuals that much more, and they were able to turn it into something that worked in their favor by when they were portraying homosexuals who were victims of AIDS in more of a sympathetic light. What's fascinating to me, and I think you did a very good job of summarizing that history, is this is not just society kind of opening its eyes to you know, these are human beings and we need to be loving toward them, and there's certainly some truth in that, but this was an active effort on the part of activists to reshape society by a very strategic and well thought out plan. And when you read what they wrote, and you brought out some of those quotes in your report, you can see just how effective they have been in just step by step by step stigmatizing opposition to homosexuality, portraying homosexuality in positive ways that have removed the stigma from that and actually turned people's views toward it around completely, brought this into the mainstream from the fringe, and it's happened so quickly. I wrote that in 2013, and here we are 6 years later, and the movement has accelerated so much more. When you talk about the public acceptance of transsexuality, that's not even addressed in that booklet. That was really more focused on homosexuality and same-sex marriage, but it's just phenomenal when you step back and you look at how rapidly this has overtaken society.
Yes, sir, for sure. I think it's really, really worrying when you see how they've been able to do all these things without society really being aware that it's been a concerted effort to do it.
Right.
The fact that people like Taylor Swift will essentially say the same thing as Kirk and Pill said in saying that people who are against homosexuality are in the dark ages, when probably she hasn't even read that article by Kirk and Pill.
Yeah.
But the exact sentiment that they wanted to communicate to the American public, they were able to do so without having the knowledge of this strategy go out to the public in that way. And that is the danger of this movement, so much that it doesn't show itself to the people, but its effects are apparent on society.
Yeah. You also brought out the point about just the way that young people are being targeted, how this is kind of the culmination of this movement, that you end up with trying to instill this this propaganda really in young minds so that they're converted before they even have a chance to think twice about it. And a lot of that is taking place behind the backs of their parents. It's happening within the schools. You brought out children's programming. That's a very interesting aspect of this.
Yes, sir. The children's television one is really worrying, because how many parents really sit with their children and watch all these shows as the children themselves are watching it? That's probably a very rare occurrence, and using television programming is a very, very sly way for them to get to those children. And they do gloss it up in pretty language. The writer and producer of the kids show My Little Pony, Michael Vogel, said that he wants to teach children to accept all kinds of differences, and that is his first priority in making this show, My Little Pony. And this is a show that so many children watch, you know, and it introduced a lesbian couple in this, which is its final season. It's been running since the 80s.
Oh, right.
It's been around for a long time.
Right.
But just something like that, a well-respected name for a show like that, or Arthur, or all these other ones, it's such a very, very clever way to get to the children unbeknownst to their parents.
Mm. Well, very interesting. We appreciate that, Rufaro. We've been talking with trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about the LGBT movement. This is this Friday is the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, and that's a big anniversary date for this movement. And of course, June is LGBT Pride Month, but Rufaro has been working on an article about this that'll be posted on thetrumpet.com here in the next day or two. We thank you so much for your time. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Today, sin is treated dismissively, even as a joke. Even many Christians are ambivalent about it. They believe that because Jesus died for our sins, sin is irrelevant once you accept his sacrifice. But what does the Bible say? God's inspired definition is this: sin is the transgression of the law. That's 1 John 3 and verse 4. The Apostle Paul would not have known what is sin except by the law. And which law? The law that says, "Thou shalt not covet." You can see that in Romans 7 and verse 7. He's talking about the Ten Commandments. Paul described this law as being holy and just and good. King David called it perfect, sure, right, and pure, more valuable than fine gold. God's law codifies the way God thinks and acts. It's an expression of his character and his nature. God is love, and his law can be summed up in that one word, love. Jesus said the law is further defined into two great commandments, love to God and love to neighbor. You can find that in Matthew 22, verses 36 to 40. That same law is further divided into 10 points by the 10 commandments. The first four of those tell us how to love God. The last six tell us how to love our neighbor. God's law of love is the perfect way of life. All suffering, unhappiness, misery, and death has come solely from breaking that law. James 2 and verse 8 says, if you fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you do well. Love is the fulfilling of the law. But it's not our human level love. It is, as Romans 5:5 says, the love of God which is shed abroad in our hearts by the Holy Spirit. If we fulfill this royal law, we do well. But if not, we commit sin. If we keep the whole law, the whole principle of love to neighbor, yet break one point of it, we are guilty, it says in James 2, verses 10 to 11. And if you look at that passage, you can see the points of law that James describes are do not commit adultery, do not kill. He's talking about the Ten Commandments. Jesus Christ was the ultimate example of perfect obedience to the law. Most Christians believe that Jesus came to earth to abolish the Ten Commandments. But he clearly stated, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Jesus magnified the law and made it honorable, it says in Isaiah 42. In other words, when we put a spiritual magnifying glass on the Ten Commandments, it is enlarged in spirit and principle into many more points. And in the larger view, the entire Bible is a magnification of God's law. The law is the basis of all Scripture. It defines a way of life, God's way to happiness, joy, and eternal life. Truly fulfilling the Ten Commandments requires keeping not just the letter of the law, but also the spirit. Christ gave two examples illustrating this point. First, he says, you have heard that it was said by them of old time, you shall not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. He said that in Matthew 5, verses 21 through 22. He quoted the sixth commandment, which forbids murder, and he affirmed that maliciously ending a human life is sin. But then he magnified that law, showing how the spirit of murder, including hatred, is also sin. The second example Christ used, he addressed the seventh commandment, saying, you've heard that it was said by them of old time, you shall not commit adultery. But I say unto you that whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. So he upheld God's law forbidding adultery, and that includes premarital sexual activity as well as infidelity within marriage. Then he magnified it, showing that even a lustful gaze breaks the spirit of that commandment. These examples show that sin against God's spiritual law begins in the mind, and it must be stopped immediately. In principle, sin is anything other than God's outflowing law of love. At the root of all sin is vanity, loving self more than loving God or fellow man. Its author was Lucifer, whose heart was lifted up because of his beauty. And it's manifest in attitudes of self-centeredness, self-exaltation, desire to be beautiful, coveting, desire to get and take, jealousy and envy, competition, resentment and a rebellion against authority, violence and war. These are the principles of spiritual sin. To repent of sin means to turn from sin, to quit sinning. And the one way to do so is to begin keeping God's commandments. All of them, for as it says in Romans 6:23, if you break only one, you incur the penalty of sin, which is not eternal life in hell, but death, eternal death. Thankfully, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ pays that death penalty. Once someone repents, he or she is no longer doomed to eternal death. However, God still expects those whom he forgives to keep the Ten Commandments. Romans 6 says, "What shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid! How shall we that are dead to sin live any longer therein?" It is now our responsibility to choose to slay sin, to choose not death, but life. If you want to learn more about this life-changing subject, request our free booklet, The Ten Commandments. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal, Brad McDonald, and Rufaro Manyepa. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with this thought from Horace Mann. Do not think of knocking out another person's brains because he differs in opinion from you. It would be as rational to knock yourself on the head because you differ from yourself 10 years ago. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.